somebody help me out here. Where is the greatest library in the ancient world?
Alexandria,
Egypt. Kind of right about there, okay? At one point in the history of the church, the Archbishop of Canterbury is from the area of Africa that we now know as Sierra Leone, okay? That may be some news for some of you. It was news for me that the Archbishop of Canterbury was African. Where is one of the greatest aesthetic cultures of the ancient world is along the Ivory Coast. It's interesting to reflect on why that's the case. If you take a look at just good old geography, along this part of the world, there was a great deal of time on people's hands, because if you look at how much time there is to get crops into the ground and get crops out of the ground, it's somewhere between 10 to 12 months of the year that the ground is fertile and active. And what that means is there's a lot of leisure, so great aesthetic cultures can emerge. Okay? Well, if that's Africa, and this is England, what's this, folks?
U.S. today.
Okay, that's the United States of America. I warned you about my map-making ability. Okay, now you know.
We're Florida.
Okay, there's Florida. Now, if that's England, and this is Africa, and that's the USA, what's this? Somebody said sometimes you hear the Bermuda Triangle. That's not quite right.
Big Bermuda Triangle.
It's the Golden Triangle or the Slave Triangle. That's right. If we take a look at that, what goes this direction in the Golden Triangle?
Raw materials,
right? Cotton is one example. What goes this way?
Manufactured goods.
Produce goods. Manufactured goods. What goes this way?
Slaves.
No. People. God's people. Who are capable of creating the greatest library in the ancient world, whose ancestors were the Archbishop of Canterbury, and who were capable of creating one of the greatest aesthetic cultures in the ancient world. It is part of our conditioning in America for us to say slaves. And I believe that it is part of the healing process for us to begin to say God's people. What I'd like to do, it would be to take a moment now to take a look at the history of slavery in America. And I need to go back to one more part of the map here. If this is the United States of America and we have God's people coming this way to become indentured servants and slaves, what's that?
The Mason-Dixon line.
Okay. Excuse me. Yeah. Everything I know about man making, I learned from Radical. Okay. What does this concept mean? And for those of you who know, just let us struggle with it a little bit, okay? What does that concept mean?
Constitution.
Okay. Let's.
Great Compromise.
The Great Compromise. What's the Great Compromise? Tell us about that.
Let me see, if I remember correctly.
So that everybody can hear you.
I believe in the North, the population was staying relatively stable.
Okay.
In the South, population was growing, but it was growing, I believe, by a lot by the slave trade.
Right.
People in the North were like, look, you know, you got people, but they're property. Are they property or are they people? Because you're getting more of both than we are.
Okay, let's take a look at that for 1 second. How many U.S. senators does each state get?
Two.
How many members of the House of Representatives?
435.
Who said it? Mary. It depends on the population. Okay, the Great Compromise, and I'm just going to chime in here because I want to move through some stuff. The Great Compromise is this. The South is beginning to complain because they have a great number of people now moving into the South. The North has more representation in the House of Representatives because they have more people that they're counting in census and therefore more representatives in the House. The great compromise is that let's say that slaves equal 3/5 of a person. Every time you get two slaves together, there's an additional person, right? But no one person can go to the polls. So it gives the South more political power, and it absolutely begins the process of another example of injustice is to help African Americans, help the South to get more members in the House of Representatives, but become ineligible by virtue of the United States Constitution. They cannot go to the polls. Okay? What does this mean? And let us struggle a little bit. What does that mean? 40 acres and a mule. What's that part of the American history around this slavery?
Reconstruction.
Okay. Frank, go ahead. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, I thought that's what was promised everybody.
Okay.
After the Civil War.
40 acres and a mule is what's promised. If you were a slave in this country after the Civil War, the Emancipation Proclamation is signed, and slaves are promised 40 acres and a mule. I'd heard about this for so long. One of my sons and I were traveling in the South in the spring and went to the incredible museum to the Civil Rights Movement in Birmingham and found the original 40 acres and a mule documents that were tried to pass twice and failed both times in the U.S. Senate. So the promise is still a promissory note, never been delivered, never made it out of the House of Representatives and actually never made it to the Senate. There is a period of brief hope here, however, in the American history as it relates to African Americans, and that is for about 2 years after slavery is abolished, we begin to see African American-owned banks, small businesses. We begin to see African Americans holding public office in small cities throughout the South, city council and mayors. And two things emerge that cut the legs out from under that momentum. Now, mind you, there is no 40 acres and a mule. Nothing has been delivered to help that, but out of a sense of exuberance, out of a sense of freedom, African Americans begin to make some progress. And two things come along that cut the legs out right from under that. What is that?
Jim Crow laws.
Jim Crow laws and the Ku Klux Klan and carpetbaggers from the North who begin to come down because of the South's great indebtedness. Homes are selling for 1/10 the price, sometimes pennies on the dollar, so are farms and other property, and carpetbaggers from the North come in and buy up every possible entryway into the market economy. Okay. Now, we're going to skip ahead here and just briefly take a look at the words of Dr. King in his famous I Have a Dream speech. In the last year, I've had an opportunity to visit the Atlanta area and the surrounding area 3 times, and have made it a point to try to make it to as many civil rights sites as possible. And what I've been reminded of is the civil rights movement, for all of the bloodshed, for all of the hard work that it took, here's what African Americans in this country were asking for. An opportunity to ride buses, an opportunity to eat at lunch counters, and an opportunity to vote. I mean, we're not talking about storming the Bastille here. We're not talking about an overthrow of a government. People would like to ride public transportation, people would like to eat at the same lunch counters, and people would like to exercise their constitutional right to vote, and we have to have a whole series of movements, a national movement, to ensure these basic rights. I'm building up to a point here. This is a wonderful image, as far as I'm concerned. Take a look at those wonderful faces. And it says that if love comes from the heart, where does hate come from? This is a document from the American National Conference of Christians and Jews, and here's what they say if you can't read it. Children aren't born knowing how to hate. they must be taught. Therefore, the lesson is simple. Let's not teach our children hatred and prejudice, because what they don't know won't hurt them or others. But we've had all of these movements. We had the civil rights movement, and yet things like this are still a part of our culture. Plain old discrimination, violent neighborhoods, rotten high schools, forgotten elementary schools. I pronounce the playing field level. Level playing field under construction. Close enough, play ball.
What was the date on that?
The date?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't see it. Sorry. It's about 3 years old. America, the great melting pot. Could it be that liberty itself is what's melting? Okay. I'm going to ask what you might think is an odd question, but I would like you to participate if you would. Raise your hand if you would like racism in this country to end this evening. Take a look around. I've been asking this question for about 10 years, and each time I ask this question, 90 to 100% of the hands in the room go up. So my question is, why in the midst of all of this goodwill does racism persist? It has persisted for centuries now, and why in the midst of this goodwill does it persist? Well, that requires us to take a look at institutional racism. And I'm going to be talking about, and this slide is not very effective, but it'll allow me to talk about it. I'm going to be talking about the work of Robert Terry, who used to be at the Humphrey Institute in Minnesota, is now an independent consultant. And he suggests that it has something to do with this diamond model. He says all institutions, you name the institution, whether it's Holden Village, or the Boy Scouts of America, or the Lutheran Church, each institution, or America, and that'll be the institution we look at, each institution is only made up of four components: mission, power, structure, and resources. The degree to which these elements of an institution, to the degree to which there is shared access, has something to do with the organization being a multicultural organization. The degree to which access is denied begins to define that institution as an exclusive organization. Now, this is Robert Terry's thinking. Let's take a look at the mission. The institution we're going to look at is the United States of America. Where would we look to find the mission of the United States of America?
Constitution.
Constitution. Who wrote that? Give me a color and a gender.
White men.
Property white male.
Okay. White male property owners. Power in this country is distributed in three branches. For the most part, who has occupied those branches of government?
White men.
We're beginning to see some changes there, but essentially white men. Structure are the laws, the statutes by which we live our lives together. For the most part, who wrote those?
White men.
And then resources has to do with the fuel of the organization. For the most part, money, and that answer is probably obvious as well. If I were to draw a circle around this, that's what Bob Terry calls the white male club. You've heard about it. There it is. It remains a club as long as we deny access based on gender, race, sexual orientation, etc. And the goal of America, and more importantly, I think the goal of our Christian lives together, is to take any institution that would be a club and turn it into a house of God. We're all people. Gentile or Jew, servant or free, woman or man, no more. All people of God are welcomed in the household. Okay, let's make this a little bit more obvious. Now, this is not true, okay, this did not happen, but to make a point, let's say that this did happen. Don and Dwayne and Brad and I got together earlier this afternoon. We went up to Sahikin to get some breathing room. This did not happen, but we'll just make a point. And on the way up in the boat, I asked them if they'd like to play Monopoly. And they kind of looked at me, and we've been kind of, you know, bored here in the village until all you folks came in today, and thank you very much for coming. So they looked at me, and they said, sure. And I said, well, you know, Don, did you bring a Monopoly game? He looked at me, and he said, no. I said, Brad, did you bring one? Nope. Dwayne, how about you? Nope. And I said, boy, it's a good thing I brought a game. You know, I've got a game, and we're on this boat, and since it's the only game in town, in addition to the Parker Brother rules, I've just got a couple rules of my own. Okay, and they all wanted to play. It was the only game around. And so they kind of looked at me suspiciously, and they said, okay, Bill, what are the rules? I said, well, I own the railroads, and I own the utility companies. I own Boardwalk and Park Place. And I'm the only one who can buy the green properties. Okay, everything else is up for grabs. So let's.
You also own the jail.
Yes. Touche. Yes, I do. And the key. Okay. So they looked at me a little suspiciously, but let's start playing. You know, so we were playing. We're about 20 minutes into it. It's only about a 40-minute ride up to Sahikin, and. You know, they began to land on properties right away. It was Brad who landed on Baltic and Mediterranean. Ooh, like I was getting nervous, right? If I land on that property, it's about $5 a shot. You know, I'm not too worried about that. He starts building houses and hotels, still not too worried about it. The rest of the property they landed on, but nobody really had a monopoly because it was divided among them. Little by little, I got a little bit of money and put houses on Boardwalk and Park Place and then the green properties, and they had to come down Dead Man's Row, right? Dead Man's Curve. And they got their measly $200, go around, go again, and it would just barely get them around go. As the game was coming to its eventual conclusion, all of a sudden, you know, if you've not just arrived here in the village, Dwayne has been teaching us about the prophets. So all of a sudden, this prophetic voice sort of rises up in Dwayne. He goes, wait a minute! He said, this game is unfair. He said, you've had more right to buy property than we have, Bill Grace. And I was looking for a strategy, so I thought about an apology. I thought, geez, Dwayne and Don and Brad, I'm sorry. You know what? From now on, you all have as much right to buy property as I do. Let's keep playing. What's going to change? Nothing. Do you know what we call that in this country? When we say, let's keep playing, you have as much right to buy property as I do. You know what we call that in this country?
Capitalism.
Affirmative action. Affirmative action is equal access to a rigged game. And now we actually want to undo affirmative action. But nobody is really willing to talk about, is the game rigged? And what would it mean to question some of the fundamental assumptions of the game and allow for more equal access? If I were to look at, and we're not this evening, going to look at issues like sexism and classism and globalism and homophobia, because oftentimes, too often, they get lumped together and it takes away our laser focus. Tonight we're going to stay focused on racism. But if I were looked at one culprit that really helps to explain why does racism and sexism persist in our country, what I'd like to suggest is that. Racism continues because racism pays. America goes from a fairly new country to a global leader economically. And it had everything to do with slavery. When you can systematically not pay people to provide labor and then systematically underpay people for a couple decades afterwards, what you have is a very, very powerful edge in an economic machine. Well, I'd like to get some help here, because I believe I'm going to share one more slide. This is, again, according to Robert Terry. He says that if we can admit in our hearts that racism does exist, that it still exists, and that it is a significant issue, maybe America's most significant problem, that we need to get our hands around in a prophetic way, in a powerful way. If we admit in our hearts that it does exist, if we can get past that debate, then Robert Terry says that we only have four choices. We can continue to be racist, or we can be anti-racist. We can do that actively, or we can do that passively. Let's take a look at all four of those choices. The active racist, okay, do you see how that works? Active racist is really only about 3 to 5% of the American people. And I think that's good news, but unfortunately, that population is growing in white supremacist groups all along around the country. And my main strategy with white supremacists is basically not to engage them, because by engaging them, I just give them more airtime. Let me take a look at this one and try to make a point, which is a little difficult, but sometimes for me to explain, but stick with me. A passive anti-racist. What I'd like to suggest is that that is not a choice. Because if the system itself, does this make sense? If the system itself is skewed racially to help others and hurt others, then to sit back and do nothing is to be racist. That it is impossible to be passive and anti-racist in a system that is racist. Because the system itself acts on our behalf when we do nothing. Bad things happen when good people do nothing. Passive racists, according to Robert Terry, and I would agree with him, is he believes is about 80% of the country, and that's because those are the good people in this culture doing nothing about it. And active anti-racist is about then 15% of the country who continue beyond the civil rights movement to insist on racial justice. My interest is to move people from this category into this category. Not only because it's the right thing to do in terms of our American citizenship, but because it's the right thing to do in relation to our faith. And Duane has been helping us to focus on the prophets these last 2 weeks, and I'd like the prophets to speak to us this evening. And I have two readings, one from Amos and one from Micah. And I'd like a volunteer to read one. We'll get another volunteer to read the next. I have them marked for you. So who would like to read a reading from Amos? I will. Amos. Starts up here. And I'll give you the specific verse in just a second. This is the prophet Amos, and we'll be hearing from chapter 5. Verses 21 through 24. Amos is addressing, in my mind, the church.
I despise your festivals, and I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them, and the offerings of well-being of your fatted animals I will not look upon. Take away from me the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the melody of your harps, but let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to just make one comment about that. We're about to enjoy some wonderful gospel music this evening. And Amos reminds us that he hates our festivals. he despises when we gather to celebrate and make music unto God, when injustice still exists in our midst. I don't know about you, but I'm very interested in at 7:30 going over and hearing and enjoying that gospel music. But I think I would enjoy it even more if I believe that this session helped to quicken in our hearts a commitment to gospel action on behalf of the racial problems that still exist in this culture. So as you're enjoying the gospel music, I hope you'll think about the gospel message and the call to gospel action in relation to race problems in America. Who would like to read the next reading from Micah?
I will.
Okay, could you pass the book back? And it's the second bookmark, the one deeper in the book. And in this case, would you please read Micah chapter 6, verses 6 through 8.
With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has told you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God?
Thank you. I have just about 3 more minutes of materials, and I'd like to open it to a conversation. I'd like to bring us back to this question, the promissory note, undelivered, and what it would mean to do justice in relation to that promissory note. And what I'd like to talk about for the next 5 minutes is the question of reparations. After we took advantage of Native American people in this country, long afterwards, we eventually saw some of the folly of that, and the churches led a commitment to publicly apologize to Native American people for mistreatment and to begin a process of economic reparations. When we interned Japanese people in this country during World War II and saw the ignorance and hatred behind that and our embarrassment, we decided once again to do justice. And the church led the way with a public apology to Japanese people and for reparations made to Japanese people for the property and businesses and economic loss that they experienced during that time. We have never apologized to African Americans in this country. We tried several times to pass it in legislation in Washington, D.C. We have tried twice to pass legislation that would give economic reparations to African Americans in this country, and it failed twice, I'd say for lack of moral courage. So what I would like to suggest this is that racism is America's deep wound. It's not only deep, but it's infected. And our generation, the generations in this room, has an opportunity. I believe now is the time for the churches once again to lead the way to a formal public apology to African American people, and for us to engage in the final delivery of the promissory note of 40 acres and a mule. Now, lest you think this is ideological only, I'd like to suggest a very practical way of doing it. And 3 of us currently in the state of Washington are working on this. If you're from Washington, would like to be a part of it, I welcome you. If you're from another state and would like to know how to start something similar in your state, I also welcome you. The state takes in billions of dollars each year in taxes. And by virtue of statute, the state is only allowed to invest those at certain levels of risk. And that yields typically somewhere between 4.5% to 5.5% interest on those dollars. The banks that the state does business with can invest those dollars easily in treasury bills or other non-risky investments, especially in the current market economy that we're in, and yield about 7% to 7.5%. Quick math suggests is that the banks are earning a very quick 2.5% to 3% on state investment dollars. Here is the suggestion. The difference between what the state is getting and what the banks are getting, economists, bankers call arbitrage. What we are recommending and will be recommending to the state of Washington is that we take 0.5% of the arbitrage and set up a loan fund for African Americans only. A loan fund to start businesses that will have two other ideas associated with it. First of all, it is a loan fund. The money will need to be paid back, but over time and at a very low interest to be determined. In addition to getting a loan, we will ask new entrepreneurs to take either a 3, 6, or 12-month class at a community college that will help them to understand how to be an effective entrepreneur. And we will hope to work with groups like the Retired Senior Volunteer Corps and a group in Washington called ESQA, the Executive Service Corps of Washington, to provide a mentor for a new African-American entrepreneur to help that person to be successful in their new venture, believing that this will not only begin a reparations process, but begin the process of giving those people a stake in the game. Do you remember the Monopoly analogy? Unless you have a stake in the game, it is a rigged game. And working for people who own property is not a way out. It is only if you have access to the game that real economic justice can be pursued. So I'd like to stop there. We've talked about three things: the history of racism in America, the how slavery has turned into institutional racism, and how racism acts unconsciously in our culture, so that even people of goodwill who do nothing, racism will flourish in that environment. And only if the church, I believe, takes moral action in light of the gospel call to do justice and love kindness and walk humbly, even though it is an Old Testament call, I believe it's echoed in the words and actions of Jesus. And only if the church acts with that sort of moral courage and compassion and God's love will we begin to put the problem of black-white tensions, black-white race problems behind us in this country. So I'd like to stop there and talk about whatever you'd like to talk about. We have about 26 minutes before we go to Vespers, I think.
You know, Bill, you mentioned something earlier that I thought that you kind of discounted the affirmative action thing. And that didn't work for me, the way you said that, and maybe you could offer a clarification on that, because you made a statement that's called affirmative action. And as I understand affirmative action, it is trying to level that playing field. And I can think of a number of examples of where it has, in terms of admittance to graduate programs, in terms of hiring minorities who would not have jobs for positions which they really aren't qualified given their present circumstances, but to give them an opportunity to get on board and to learn to grow into the job.
Right.
And I know several examples of this personally. And so maybe I misunderstood you, but I thought that...
No, you didn't. I think affirmative action is, as I said, I think it is attempting to give equal access to a rigged game. I think it is not a deep enough cure. I believe that the cure that I'm suggesting will call for sacrifice. Affirmative action gives people of color and women and people with handicaps access to a game that is not has not been developed. Remember the diamond model? they don't have, people of color have not had access to the mission and power questions. Mm-hmm. We bring them in as resources into a game that's already established, and we call that justice. Justice is about giving them access to the questions of power and to the questions of mission.
On the other hand,
we have been historically afraid to do that.
I didn't want to be a guy. I was just thinking that one way that you get into that game is through having a job and where you feel good about yourself and where you feel empowered and where you can start saving some money,
right,
and putting some money into the market and start owning some property and become part of the power structure.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not suggesting that it is an evil plan, but it is not a fully conceived plan. I can remember when I was a kid, when if I would fall down off my bike and scrape my knee, what I was hoping my mother would do would be to just put a Band-Aid on it. But what she wanted to do was to scrub the wound first and to get deep into the problem, because it was her opinion that it would be much less likely for there to be an infection.
My dying on it.
Right. Yeah. And my belief is that affirmative action is like topical ointment for a much deeper problem.
Well, what about your definition of justice? I've missed the other session. Could you bring us up to, how you use the term justice?
Justice for me is how are the least advantaged people in culture cared for. And I believe that's what I would call biblical justice. Justice has become, the definition in America has become equal access. And then the cartoons about level playing field under construction, close enough play ball. I believe that that's what we have come to call justice. And that's not my understanding of biblical justice.
Have you drafted legislation, Bill, or is this?
At this point, we have not. I now serve on the board of the Church Council of Greater Seattle, and there's a subcommittee of the Church Council that is going to be recommending this, first of all, to the Church Council to take on the role of animating a statewide public apology. And it's our goal in the next 6 months to approach members of the state legislature as well as the governor. If we believe that it could be as easy as an executive order to just instruct banks to share the arbitrage in a special loan fund. We don't think that this is revolutionary, but we've just begun that planning process. Dwayne and this gentleman.
Yeah. Well, this bit of the firm of action, because just before I came in here, I was reading the lead article in yesterday's Christian Science Monitor, which was on affirmative action. And I remember sort of three things about what's happening in California, the issues that are now going to be surprised perhaps this fall by the Supreme Court that will really determine the future on this area, and then proposed legislation that's coming up in Congress on this. And I don't know what the Supreme Court is going to do, but the other two indicate very clearly we're moving away from affirmative action, but they are not moving in the direction that you're talking about in justice. They're moving 180 degrees in the other direction.
Yeah.
That's where the mood of the country is.
Not only is it topical ointment, we're not going to use the topical
ointment. Yeah, and that's what I'm going
to call it straight. I want to learn your name.
Donald King.
So,
yeah.
Go ahead.
You talked a little bit about an actual bill or some assistance through the arbitrage, 1.5% and stuff. There's something similar now in the state, the link deposit program for businesses. Probably have two questions then on that. One is it related to that existing program at all? And two is why is there a conclusion that it needs one to be something to entrepreneurs,
right,
which only,
right,
even among white males is a small percentage,
right,
of people that want to make a living. And why a loan, which means,
right,
you have to be a successful entrepreneur to pay,
right,
it back, could actually get you into more trouble and help.
We're very early in the process of determining all of those. There are only three people who have met thus far to begin to look at this. For those of you from the Seattle area, Norwood Brooks, and another gentleman who's just arrived in town who has some experience in the banking and lending industry. and was working part-time with the church councils and a parish partner program, bringing predominantly African-American and white churches together. And it's our goal to sort of step up the dialogue in the state of Washington around racial justice. We've not concluded. Matter of fact, we're in the midst of discussion. Is an entrepreneurial loan fund the way to go? Maybe that's part of it. Should there be an education fund? What are the other ways in which reparations make sense? We don't believe we've found any perfect combination of how to spend those dollars, but that we believe that we want to begin a conversation around economic reparations and package it in such a way that we can get progress on some front. My own belief is if you put too much in it, it's probably going to be debated forever and maybe come away limping. But if it's an initial attempt of a multi-stage effort, then we may be more effective. But it's the conversations are about a month old on this, so this has just begun. Frank?
Yeah, well, building on what Donald's just said is that one of the things that we did, I'm from Seattle, by the way, and one of the things that we did and actually been copied in a number of government jurisdictions is to say that for any public construction project, that a certain percentage go to people of color getting into the apprenticeship programs. And now the City of Seattle, the Port of Seattle, the Seattle School District, and now King County have adopted that.
Right.
So that it's like, I think it's 15 or 20% of those apprenticeships. And then over time, as people go through apprenticeships and become, you know, fully trained, this definitely is a change in how it used to be, particularly construction trains.
And I believe
the same thing could possibly happen with the state of Washington, which, you know, funds $1 billion in construction. Or no more than that, actually, about $1.5 billion each year. And most of that goes for wages.
Frank is also a member of our state legislature, so it's absolutely wonderful to have him in our group.
Oh, my cover.
But that's also affirmative action, right?
Oh, yeah, it's affirmative action. The thing I'm worried about is right now in this state, there's an issue being put together to throw out affirmative action.
Right.
And it's like, it's unbelievable. You know, you think that 300 years of outright slavery, you can make up for it with 30 years of low firm action. It's totally absurd.
It is absurd. Thank you. Donald, I missed your. You're with the governor's office, you said?
No, me. Oh, I was just saying he's my
okay.
representative.
I was going to start taking notes. Okay. Peter?
I don't quite know how to phrase this, but it seems like it's a great proposal, but it's almost as though it's letting African Americans into a different kind of a rigged game, and that's the relationship that the U.S. economy has with the rest of the world. In a way, you know, teaching them to be good American capitalistic entrepreneurs.
So they can exploit everybody else like the rest of them.
Well, that's what I was thinking a little bit.
This gentleman here, and then you.
Well, Carol, do you have a comment to this particular?
Oh, well, I kind of was, because I think about, I'm an African American, I'm also Native American, and I think about, I don't know if you talk about privilege, but I think it's just a matter of not so much getting into the capitalistic head, but I think it's a matter of having, at least being at the table so you can make a decision about how you're going to wield and deal with these resources, and having some kind of a piece that you can pass on through generations. We've been stripped of our ancestors, and we've been stripped of any of that kind of support that lends itself at least to some kind of, you know, passing on, you know, the betterment for the next generation of your children. And I think it's only been 40 years, literally, of times that we've been able to, as African Americans, hold positions and be in any kinds of positions of power. I mean, it's just really not been that long of a time. So, I think we got a long way to go to even begin to get that.
And I would hope, first of all, I don't think that the market economy in and of itself is anything corrupt in the right understanding of the market economy. The market economy was a, you know, human invention to help with the distribution of goods and services to create good societies. I, for one, if an individual has understood what it meant to be taken advantage of, what it meant to be oppressed, and could carry that wisdom into an opportunity where they had a chance to express power, that gives me a great deal of hope that maybe the market economy itself can become redeemed, because it doesn't have to be people with money taking advantage. Could be a very, very powerful source for good if we decided, for instance, to steer the market economy to make sure that everybody in this country had something to eat, had a house to live in, had health care, had access to basic education. We could steer the market economy in that way through tax incentives and disincentives. So the market economy could be a tool for good. And I trust people who, understand what it means to be taken advantage of to help bring goodness back into the equation.
Yeah, I was wondering, why don't you limit this proposal to African-Americans? There are other disadvantaged groups as well. There's a lot of very, very poor white people, Vietnamese, and you name it. What about these enterprise zones that Jack Kim, for example, has proposed to many other folks for inner cities and oppressed areas in our country?
My answer to that question, and I respect the question a lot, but this is what, I don't know if you can all see this. This is sort of,
that can be you'll never guess.
If you saw me trying to draw with my left hand, now I'm going to try with my right.
Why don't you do it?
You see better on that board?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, let's say that this is the American pie. Okay, can you see that?
Yeah.
Okay, let's say that that's the American pie. When the Civil Rights Movement began in the, depending on how far back you want to go, in the late 40s, 50s, and 60s, ultimately the question was, we'd like a piece of the pie. And so when African Americans, after helping to lead the Civil Rights Movement, ultimately said, okay, there's your piece of the pie. And all of a sudden, Hispanics were watching that going, hey, wait a minute, we'd like a piece of the pie. And women were saying, hey, we'd like a piece of the pie. And we said, hey, no problem. There you go. And women, we'd like a piece of, no problem. There you go. And then we say, why is it that people of color fight amongst themselves? And that's why Jesse Jackson, I think, created the Rainbow Coalition. Let's work together on this stuff. My particular caution is that I think this has everything to do with healing between blacks and whites. And unless we, this is emotional for me, unless we deal with that issue singularly, unless we focus on that issue and not be distracted by other good causes, we will water down our efforts, we will water down our resolve, and we'll come out with something less than what I would call justice.
I took a class in American history, and part of that was to look at the Constitution. One of the things that really aggravated me in that class to find out that black men or black people were valued as three-fourths human being. I think it was due to the elections in the South or head count or whatever in the South. But that is still there.
Yes.
And one of my questions to the professor was, has anybody thought to change this perception of black people in which as three-fourths human? Because that perception gives you the right to almost do anything to us because we are less than human, subhuman, and that perception still prevails today. And I wonder, why is it not that you're not doing something?
While you were still probably working with choir, we talked at the beginning about the three-fifths rule, which is written into our Constitution. It's there. And I think I agree with your perception that we may have revoked the law, but we have not done the same with our images.
That's right.
And I believe only a public apology in the spirit of, in the presence of God, gets to resolving that question. And then the apology, in my mind, is hollow unless it has economic support structures beneath it, because in a market economy, that is the way in which you get access to the game, is by some form of economic encouragement, whether through school loans or apprenticeship programs or a stake in the economy as a business owner. I thank you. I want to make sure I'm not missing hands up there. We've got about 8 minutes before we should probably make our way over for Vespers. But.
Bill, I just have a comment in that, you know, it's great to have talks about these kinds of things.
Right.
And everything else. But where do you go from here, and what do we, you know, what do we, do you talk about active, passive?
Thank you.
And that area, because we can talk about it all day long.
Right.
Talk about it for years. But what do you suggest that we go on out and do?
Thank you for that question. I really do believe that Terry's notion is helpful to us here. If we were to look at this and say that there really only are four choices. I've really never met a racist face-to-face, an active racist, and I'm grateful for that, meaning a skinhead. We said that passive anti-racist doesn't exist, because if we do nothing, bad things will continue to happen. So there's only two choices. Will you be passive or will you be active? And I believe that, I love that part of the liturgy, this is out of the Lutheran Church, if you can remember this with me. It is indeed right and salutary that we should at all times and all praises give praise and etc. And I believe that it is indeed right and salutary, and that means it's good for us, to become active antis. And my belief is, unless you figure out something that you're going to do, no matter how big or small, before the sun sets tonight, it'll be too late. Vespers will begin in about a half hour, probably by the time Vespers is over. If you have found something that you will do, preferably in your local community. If you've not found something by the time Vespers is over, you probably won't do anything. And so I just invite you into prayer on that. And I believe that the Spirit desires for there to be racial healing in this country, and that you'll be working in cooperation with the Spirit if you search your heart for something that you can do.
You know, interestingly, you said that you've never met an active racist, and I think something to say on the positive side as far as where we are as people in this country goes, you could meet a skinhead, you could meet a member of the American Nazi Party, you could meet the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan. Each one of them would say they're not racist. Each one of them would say they don't hate people.
Right.
I think that's important in the sense that for a greater part of this country, we made it a shameful thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So shameful that not even the Ku Klux Klan will say that they hate,
right,
or that they're racist.
Thank you.
They will come up with a number, I mean, they'll use affirmative action, they'll use a number of other issues, not unlike a lot of other people that aren't Ku Klux Klan.
Right.
So they sound mainstream.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I think it's dangerous in one sense. But I think the other side, the positive side that you want to look at is that in this country now, we've made it embarrassing, we've
right,
made it shameful, we've made it not unacceptable, politically incorrect. And all of those things, I mean, we've made it a lot of negative pieces. New racists now have a different look and language to them.
Thank you. And thank you for that note of hope, because ultimately, here's what I believe about ethical leadership. Ethical leadership means that you look the hardest problems of the culture right in the eye. We don't pretend that they're not there. We look them right in the eye and we do some hard discernment. And then our task as Christians, I believe, is to find hope. Okay, that's what we're called to. So thank you for helping us see that hope and also reminding us that there might be a new shell game in town of having the right talk but not having the walk. And what I'd like to remind us of is, what would the walk look like? What is something that you'll do? I believe that God is a God of action verbs, you know. Do justice, love kindness, walk humbly. Those are action verbs. And if we would like to be a part of the solution, find an action verb that you will associate yourself with.
There's a saying that I was at a conference, and one of the speakers ended the conference. It was a conference for African American women in health, and that's my field in health. And it stuck with me since, and the quote is, "Those who are wrong to succeed, take those who are right to do nothing. Those who are wrong to succeed, take those who are right to do nothing."
Thank you.
In other words, to be passive, right?
Say it again?
In other words, to be passive,
yes.
Not active.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yes. Bad things require that. I was about to go off on a tangent, but I'll withhold. Yeah.
I want to ask you, what makes you think that it's the dream of every black person to be an entrepreneur?
I don't claim to know that. But it is my belief that unless we create clear opportunity for that choice to be legitimately pursued, we won't know.
Well, I'm thinking from a different angle. I know of a church in Spokane, for instance, who exchanged or they cooperated in services with the black.
Right.
They had combined church services. Now, it seems to me that kind of thing is just as important as giving somebody money to get school.
Yes. I talked earlier, I don't know if you were here, about I'm involved in helping to lead a Parish Partners program in Seattle that has pulpit exchanges and choir exchanges and mutual ministries and outreach to the community. And I absolutely believe you're absolutely right, because that's where relationships and friendships are built. And then it's more difficult for me to have my friend in an unjust position. So I agree with you. But in addition, I believe that, sort of like my mother's desire to scrub the wound, we are also called to deeper action.
I missed that because I was a choir with a wonderful black choir director.
Thank you. Yes.
Well,
this will probably be our last comment, but I'd like to end with a moment of silence.
That lady's question does beg the question. With the Japanese Americans, they were given straight monetary reparations, just a lump sum. How come you apparently bypass that option?
We haven't really bypassed any options. I believe that politics is the art of the possible. And as I look at what's possible in this economy that we're in, I believe that this loan fund is a first step in terms of the art of what's possible.
Thank you.